Good morning, Council. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Okay, very good. Then I will call our case this morning, State versus Muth. Attorney Juris, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Hannah Juris, and it is my great privilege to appear before the court today on behalf of Attorney General Josh Call and the state of Wisconsin. Restitution is the rule and not the exception. This court has emphasized that important principle, and it informs both of the issues before the court today. It tells us that where permissible, we default to a yes to restitution instead of a no. I'm going to begin by addressing how our restitution statute permits crime victims to recover lost marital income, and then I will turn to why the release agreement that Muth's car insurance company entered with the victims does not offset the restitution ordered here. Wisconsin proudly and strongly protects both victims of crimes and spouses within marriages. Here, everyone agrees that HM and KM, the daughters of the woman Muth killed, are victims of his crime. And outside of Muth's offset argument, there is no dispute that HM and KM were permitted to receive as restitution income that they personally lost. So the only question before the court is whether, in order to make these victims whole, our restitution statute permits the circuit court to order income that under Wisconsin law belongs just as much to them as it does to their husbands. Three broad protective statutory schemes come together here to tell us that the answer to that question is yes, by giving us the what, the who, and the how.
Our restitution. Before you get into that, could you tell me whether you are relying on 973.20 sub 5 sub A or sub B or both for the restitution claim in this case?
Yes, both would apply here, Your Honor. And I think the court could start with either. I would suggest the court starts with the income lost provision because that specifically discusses income. But then if it felt that somehow that didn't provide for the coverage, it moved to special damages.
All right. So sub 5 sub B says that restitution is due to the person against whom a crime was committed. Is it the state's position that the phrase, the person against whom a crime was committed, comprehends the entirety of the definition of victim within 950.02 sub 4?
Yes, Your Honor. And to explain a bit further why that interpretation makes sense, first, as Your Honor noted, everyone agrees here that the definition of victim that's applicable is the definition set forth in the Crime Victim Rights Statute, that's 950.02 sub 4. And 950.02 sub 4 defines victim as a person against whom a crime was committed. And that same statute then tells us that where that person is deceased, we loop in and include family members, which includes adult children. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that when we read that language, person against whom a crime considered at sentencing was committed, in 973.20 sub 5 sub B, we must read that language broadly and liberally. And so a broad and liberal reading would certainly include victim, and that takes us right back to 950.02 sub 4. Just one additional point as to why that interpretation makes sense. Note that 973.20 sub 5 tells us that a court may order that restitution in any case. Prior to 973.20 sub 5, we have other restitution provisions that only apply in certain types of cases. So for example, 973.20 sub 4 tells us that it only applies in cases of death. And so what that shows us is that when the legislature means to restrict restitution to only certain types of cases, it's going to tell us that. Knowing all of that, it would be odd for the legislature to have told us that the income lost provision could apply in any case, and then at the same time have categorically exclude from that section applicability in the worst of the worst criminal cases, i.e. homicide cases. But if a person against whom a crime considered at sentencing was committed had that narrower definition, then that could never apply in homicide cases.
Counsel, are you also really focusing on the words income lost? And how, when you're focused on those words, how do you address the opposing counsel's view that this is a public policy determination and that without a definition of income loss to include, for example, a spouse's income, that it really just is confined to those for whom, against whom a crime was committed?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'd like to confront my opponent's argument head on that the state is asking this court to read language and to advance a policy position. That overlooks harmonization of the statute, the plain language of the statute, and the purpose of the statute. Perhaps the easiest way to see why our interpretation is correct and his is not is this, that under our interpretation, all of the relevant laws here work in perfect harmony. We have no conflict with regard to either plain language or purpose. But under Moot's interpretation, suddenly now we have a significant harmonization problem. We would have a conflict between the plain language of the restitution statute, which, as Your Honor noted, allows for recovery of income lost, and the marital property laws of Wisconsin that establish a presumption that income earned by either spouse belongs equally to both spouses. We would also have, beyond the plain language, a significant harmonization problem with regard to the purposes of these chapters. Both the restitution statute and the marital property chapter serve broad protective purposes and establish, in essence, default yeses. And yet, under Moose's interpretation, these broad protective schemes, when coming together, should be interpreted narrowly to say no and not protect. And that simply doesn't make sense. Turning to the plain language, because of course that's where any statutory interpretation is going to begin, Moose's position that we're asking the court to advance a policy argument really overlooks the fact that because of the important purpose of the restitution statute, this court, when reading that plain language, must apply a broad and liberal reading. So a broad and liberal reading of the language of the restitution statute necessarily is going to mean that this court will look for a way to reasonably read its language to include restitution instead of exclude. And so a broad and liberal reading of the term income includes marital income. How do we know this? Because again, our marital property laws establish a default in Wisconsin that income earned by either spouse belongs equally to both.
Counsel, I want to challenge you on that. I heard you say earlier that income belongs equally to both. The circuit court took that to mean that the net income, let's say the husband earned $500 a month, that $500 is both hers and his. But doesn't the plain language of marital property say all that is hers is a present undivided one-half interest?
It does say that, but those two things are the same. And the reason they're the same is because it's an undivided interest when they're married. If she could only receive half of it, then it would be a divided interest. And so I think the way the marital property laws work in operation is that when spouses are married, they both have full ownership. And I would just...
I don't think so. What can you point me to that would state that, other than the language that you reference? And I think I read the language differently. I read the language, each spouse has a present undivided one half interest. Each spouse out of the $500 hypothetical gets $250. That's what how I read the marital property statute. One half interest. That's what you get out of the $500. You're reading it as though, oh, he gets $500. That means she's entitled to $500.
Sure. I don't have, and I've looked, I don't have case law to point to, Your Honor, to that addresses that precise question. I think the plain language of the marital property law tells us that, and I understand Your Honor views it differently. Perhaps an example of a hypothetical would show the fact that, would show help illustrate that point. Because I think in reality, we're already applying that rule that each spouse has complete ownership of all of it during the marriage in the context of restitution. We just aren't necessarily thinking about the fact that that's what we're doing. So let's say, for example, a woman is the victim of a purse snatching. And right before her purse is stolen, she had cashed her husband's paycheck. Would we really be saying that she is only entitled to restitution for half of the money stolen from her purse because the other half belongs to her husband? No, I don't think we would. And I think the same principle is true here. Otherwise, if she were only entitled to 50% of it, then it wouldn't be an undivided interest. And well, one other...
But it doesn't say undivided interest. That's the problem. It says undivided one half interest. That's what her ownership is. As I read sub three, each spouse has a present undivided one half interest. Doesn't have a full interest. Again, respond if you will.
Sure. So I would also direct Your Honor to 766, I believe it is 31 sub 7 sub F, which talks about a personal injury recovery by one spouse during marriage. And what it tells us is that a personal injury recovery is generally considered individual income or individual property, not marital property, except for the amount attributable to income loss during the marriage. And so I think that's also a demonstration of the fact, it supports the point that when we're talking about lost income and marital property, we're thinking about equal full ownership. Because if Your Honor's one half position were correct, then ultimately, at the end of the day, that amount would be reduced in essence to a fourth interest, because then the person would only be able to recover half. And then once that split, we're down to a fourth. So I'm not sure if that's exactly the same.
Well, what
here?
Final question, I guess, is what do you do with the language then? One half, should it be instead each spouse has a present undivided interest? Is that what you're advancing? And you kind of read out one half?
We're not reading out one half. The one half component of the interest becomes relevant upon dissolution of the marriage. So what the way that language works is that it's a present undivided one half interest. So it's a present undivided interest. It becomes a one half, the one half language becomes relevant then when it's divided.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
So taking up Justice Bradley's hypothetical, the $500 income, does the wife have the authority to spend all $500?
She has certain authority. Well, I would have to look at the specific terms. I think it depends on what exactly she's spending. But I think in the context of the marriage, she would have the ability to spend that $500.
Right. So would it be logical to look at this undivided one-half interest as according to the following? The one-half interest describes the ownership relationship between the couple. The undivided interest describes the relationship between the couple and the rest of the world.
Yes, that's a good way to look at it, Your Honor. And so, and that furthers the important purposes of the marital property statute, which again goes to the fact that during a marriage, what's his is hers and what's hers is his.
Counsel, I didn't read the appeals, the briefs filed in the appeal before the Court of Appeals, but I certainly did read the opinion of the Court of Appeals. And the opinion of the Court of Appeals suggests to me that the state is changing its position. Footnote 3 in the Court of Appeals brief states as follows. As the state notes, the circuit court included the full amount of the spouse's lost wages in the restitution order, even though, as the victims, HM and KM's marital property interest would only be one half of that income, citing 766.31 sub 3 and sub 4. So have you changed, has the state changed its position, or is the Court of Appeals wrong in setting forth the state's position in footnote 3?
We have absolutely not changed our position, and thank you for pointing that out. That footnote is problematic because the state has always maintained that the circuit court's order should be affirmed, and that order was for the entirety of the restitution ordered here. I'm not exactly sure how the Court of Appeals got to that point, other than the fact that we in our brief to the Court of Appeals noted the plain language of the marital property law that again provides for that present undivided one-half interest.
Counsel, could you talk to me a little bit more about the difference between sub 5A and B? If we take the language by the person against whom a crime was committed to simply mean all victims, how is sub B not fully subsumed within sub A?
I appreciate the question. What we see in our restitution statute is that there are a lot of provisions that potentially overlap, which I know is different than perhaps many other statutes. And I think that, again, reflects the broad protective purposes of the restitution statute. Frankly, most of the other provisions of the restitution statute could also be considered special damages, because in the context of the restitution statute, a special damage means any pecuniary loss paid out resulting from the crime. And so I don't think, whereas in other statutory interpretation questions, it would perhaps be problematic to have that overlap because we would view that language as superfluous. Here, that's not a concern because, again, we have this broad protective statute with potentially overlapping provisions.
Well, is there anything that A allows that B does not? And is there anything that B allows that A does not?
B does not, I think B is narrower in that it has to be income lost resulting from either the filing of charges or cooperation with the prosecution of the crime or the investigation. So in that way, the lost income has to be tied to, in essence, the court proceedings and working with the state. So I think that does make it narrower than the special damages provision.
Right. So then does B allow any items of restitution that A does not?
Does B allow? No, Your Honor. I don't think so.
All right. So functionally, B is superfluous.
I would not view it as superfluous. I would view it as, in essence, a belt and suspenders kind of function. But I would also point, also some reiterate.
Some would say that's the definition of superfluous.
Fair enough. But this court in the past has recognized that there are going to be times where the legislature uses belt and suspender functions in statutory provisions. And I think it's entirely consistent with the purposes of the restitution statute that our legislature would have done that here, given again that the goal is to, in essence, give a menu of options to circuit courts to fulfill it, the circuit court's statutory duty to impose restitution unless the court finds a substantial reason not to do so.
Should we look for interpretations of A and B that would lead us away from a belt and suspenders interpretation?
This court could, but I don't think it needs to do so. Again, just given the fact that, frankly, most of the provisions of the restitution statute would also fall under 973 sub 25A, the special damages provision. It could do that. I don't think it needs to do that. Just to conclude on our argument, where this
perhaps you could spend a little bit of time on accord and satisfaction. And in particular, I'm interested in why accord and satisfaction would not be an available defense, since the statute gives the defendant the ability to raise any defense that he'd be able to raise in a civil action. And I'm particularly interested in, if accord and satisfaction is not one of those defenses, what are the defenses available to the defendant under that provision?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So as this court explained in Sweat, the any defense language of 97320 sub 14 means any defense as to the amount of restitution. And so as the Court of Appeals then held in Walters, answering the very question that's before the court, brought before the court by Moot today, what that means in the context of accord and satisfaction is that whereas in a civil claim, accord and satisfaction would function as a complete bar to liability, accord and satisfaction in the context of a determination of a criminal restitution order may only be a defense as to amount.
That would be set off, wouldn't it?
I think the effect of it in the context of criminal restitution would look similar to set off, but
is there any way in which it would look different?
The effect would not look different, but the nature of the civil agreement might look different, right? So it would be that, so let's say, for example, that a defendant and victim suffered $10,000 total loss in special damages. The parties agree, if you pay $2,000, that will fully resolve those claims. And then the defendant pays the $2,000, so now we have accord and satisfaction in the context of the civil matter. With regard to restitution, that cannot bar the circuit court from then fulfilling its obligation to order restitution. Instead, it would just be able to reduce the amount of restitution by that $2,000. Now, that would be...
One of the things that I find confusing about this, if the argument is that, you know, that restitution is something that the state, you know, has a right to participate in, that it can't be bargained away, you know, as you put in your briefs. But if you sort of acquiesce to the idea that set off is allowed, aren't those same concerns present? And so I don't quite understand the distinction, particularly in light of the statutory language, as Justice Kelly's suggestion. The question suggests.
So the difference, I think, is that the goal of the criminal court is to make, the primary goal is to make crime victims whole. The secondary goal is punishment and rehabilitation of the defendant. And so those objectives aren't served by allowing a victim to receive more money than he or she actually lost. But until the unless the victim has received more money than he or she actually lost, both the primary purpose of the restitution statute to compensate and make the victim whole must be served. And in so doing, the court is also serving the secondary objective of punishing and rehabilitating the defendant.
Counsel, in our cases in Hummel and Sweat seem to have language that, you know, Walters, that are at least discordant with Walters. Walters indicated that it was dicta, but in Hummel, you have this, I see your time is up. I'll just finish my question. Maybe you can just, you can answer quickly if the chief says, but Hummel seems to say court and satisfaction is a valid defense, which seems to conflict with what Walters said. And I wondered if you might respond to that.
Yes, please answer Justice Hagedorn's question. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court looked affirmatively to Walters in Hummel. The accord and satisfaction language in Sweat, as the Court of Appeals explained in Walters, has to really be read in its context. And that context is rejecting the idea that a civil settlement agreement could bar liability for restitution, but permitting defenses that relate to amount of restitution. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Mishlov, are you ready to proceed?
If I may have just a moment, Your Honor, to set my timer. Thank
you. Okay. All right. Now, the timing, you know, will be in the corner. Right now, you have a green start sign, and you'll get 5 minutes as a warning and a red stop. Please begin.
Thank you. May it please the court and Madam Chief Justice. Before I start, I have to comment on the surreal times we live in. If my dog comes and bothers me or the cat knocks things over, I hope the court will forgive me. I would like to start first on the issue that, from Mr. Muth's perspective, is moot, and that's the marital property issue. We believe it's moot because, of course, we believe that all of the restitution has been satisfied with an accord and a satisfaction of that accord. However, I do want to address some of the state's points. In terms of Justice Kelly's question about sub A and sub B of the restitution statute and whether they are the same, Muth views them as very differently. Sub A provides that a victim may recover those items of damages that may be recoverable in a civil action. Sub B talks about recovering damages as a result of participating in the investigation of the crime. Those are entirely different. And in particular, I doubt in the context of a civil action, a plaintiff could recover time spent in court. And yet, certainly a crime victim can recover for time spent in court under sub B. Similarly, the recoverable in a civil action language is where we look to limit the whole marital property argument the state is making. The state is arguing that a non-injured party can recover, the state is arguing that an injured party can recover for the lost income of a non-injured party under the marital property law. And I was interested, and I had to look very quickly at the state's reference to 766.31 sub 7F of the marital property law, which is about as close, I think, as the state comes to this. And I don't read it the same way. What that law says is that if a victim recovers lost income, the non-victim spouse has a right to that lost income. That is far different from saying that a victim spouse can recover for lost income of a non-victim spouse. And that, I think, emphasizes the point we're trying to make. The legislature has set up very specific rules about how marital property applies in damages in civil actions. And this is what the state is arguing is outside of that. And the restitution.
Yes. Counsel, one question. You started off by saying that the issue is moot. So is it your position that if we agreed with you on the accord and satisfaction issue, that the release, which were signed by the children, takes care of the issues as it relates to their spouse's lost income?
Yes, I see the importance of the issue, and the court may wish to address it, but I also think it would be a moot issue as to the specific rights of the parties in this case. Yes.
So, Mr. Mishlov, when we look at the word income lost in sub 5 sub B, and we think about a situation where the individual, say the daughter, one of the daughters here, doesn't work themselves outside the home, wouldn't it be true that income lost would include the income that she would have gotten from her spouse who took off the time, who participated in the prosecution, otherwise fitting that subsection? That's the first part of the question. And the second part, I know we focused a lot on this present undivided one-half interest, but I would note that the title of that is a survivor interest, and that this is not coming into play in trying to figure out income divided between two married people once one has passed. So can you address both of those issues, please?
As to the court's first question, I think that is the heart of the matter. And if you read the marital property statute, the state's argument has a lure. The problem with that is that more specific statutes, such as 766.31 sub 7F and the restitution statute, don't say that. And there's no authority from any marital property state to indicate that a injured spouse has a right to collect the lost income of a non-injured spouse, either in a civil tort action or in restitution. So while I have to agree with the state that their reading of the statute makes sense, there simply is no authority for that, and it is an extension of the laws that exist today. It's not simply harmonizing statutes. It's creating a whole new right of action, and our position is that's a matter for the legislature. As to the whether the interest is undivided or divided one-half interest, I am a bit at a loss. I read the statute that it provides, if it provides anything, it provides a one-half interest, because although it is true that the victim spouse, in this case the wife, has the right to spend all that money, so does the non-victim spouse, the husband, and he is definitely not a victim. So the equitable thing under that would be that the interest be one-half. An undivided one-half interest versus an undivided interest period.
Counsel, wouldn't you agree, though, that if, in this case, a woman's spouse has lost wages, that she, the wife, would also feel that as a loss if you look at a married couple as an economic unit?
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor. Our position is that the state's policy arguments and equity arguments make perfect sense. And we think they should be addressed by the legislature.
But is there anything in the statute that forecloses that recovery?
I think sub A of the restitution statute says that a crime victim may recover the kind of damages that would be recoverable in a civil action. I know of no authority that says a non-victim spouse can recover the lost, or excuse me, that a victim spouse, I keep getting that backwards, there's no authority for a victim to recover lost income of a non-victim spouse in any civil action.
I don't think either party briefed it, but do you think that subsection 13 sub A comes into play at all? In that provision, it provides the court in determining whether to order restitution and the amount thereof shall consider all of the following. And the first one is the amount of loss suffered by any victim as a result of a crime considered at sentencing.
Well, victim is defined.
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Victim is defined under Chapter 950, and it certainly excludes the spouse of a victim. No.
But you did agree with me that in this case, the wife would have felt the loss of her husband's income. So it was a loss to her if we look at the married couple as an economic unit.
I agree with that, yes.
So subsection 13 could operate as a catch-all, perhaps.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because the victim statute is specific and does not include that. Honestly, that is truly about all we have to say on the marital property issue. We view the accord and satisfaction, the extrinsic evidence, and the double recovery arguments as being more significant from Mr. Moot's perspective. So if I may go there. The issue here is whether or not these victims are getting a double recovery and whether or not a defendant in this situation must adduce extrinsic evidence. Any defenses language of the statute, certainly, and under the case law, everything but Walters suggests that accord and satisfaction is a defense. In the Court of Appeals decision, I thought it was significant that they never mentioned, or the Court of Appeals did not mention accord and satisfaction, only set off. And those are very different concepts. Muth argued both of them before the trial court. We preserved both of those issues, but this really revolves on the accord and satisfaction issue. I think the state in its argument wants to conflate those two concepts and talks about accord and satisfaction as a set-off. That's simply a misunderstanding. It is true that Muth had the burden to prove the amount of damages that were attributable to special damages as opposed to general damages. The problem is that proof is in the nature of the accord between the victims and Muth by his insurance company as to those damages. So it is conceptually incorrect to say that the accord bars the claim, or that, although it is a complete...
Doesn't your argument overlook that the amount that was paid by the insurance company may not have been even close to the amount of the damages of those injured by your client's action?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I think that really comes to the heart of the issue. The state talked about the state's interest in victims being made whole. And we acknowledge that. And in our briefs, Muth argued that what's really going on here, the underlying equitable issue, is the notion that these victims were not made whole. The $100,000 just wasn't enough money. That may very well be true, in which case this court should fashion a made whole rule rather than a rule concerning use of extrinsic evidence to prove the meaning of a contract that's unambiguous and specific in identifying its damages.
Isn't that your client's burden at the hearing to show, what part of the settlement, if any, made the victims whole?
It is our client's burden, but it's our position that showing the specific accord which specifically identified the items of damages, resolved that in the nature
of... It only resolves it if $100,000 was sufficient to resolve all of the items listed in the document prepared by the insurance company. Otherwise, I don't quite get your argument if you haven't shown that $100,000 was sufficient.
Your Honor, the $100,000 was sufficient because the victims specifically agreed.
Wasn't it a policy limit of $100,000?
Yes.
Okay, well, what are they going to agree to? That's all you're going to pay. The insurance company is not going to cough up more than $100,000. So if they want to get what they can get from someone that has a pocketbook, they have to agree to accept $100,000. I mean, they're not going to get $150,000 if that was what should have been the damages, correct?
I agree with that. In counterpoint, I would simply say that the victims had access to the money quickly. It was uncontested, and there were items of damages that could have been contested.
Well, I know, and that's congratulations to the insurance company that they paid their policy limits when they knew that that's where they were sitting with this kind of a claim. But we're looking at something different than whether the insurance company did what it was obligated to do under its contract.
So our position, Your Honor, is that in terms of apportionment and the Court of Appeals talked about, Muth didn't prove what portion of this settlement was for the specific special damages. And our position is Muth was not required to do that. What we were, and in fact, we wouldn't have been allowed to do it because there was an explicit specific agreement, which distinguishes it from Walters. And the fact that the victims entered into an accord to resolve the issue of special damages, and we could have contested whether the lost wages and the funeral expenses were reasonable and necessary and so on, certainly the lost wages. The victims entered into this accord and they agreed to it. The benefit to them is that they had immediate access to the money and there was no dispute. The benefit to Muth, of course, is that he resolves this. So itemizing the damage.
Mr. Schultz, isn't the real issue that $100,000 included general and specific damages? And you raise a very good point that if there was double recovery, so let's say, for example, there wasn't general damages included in that amount and it was only special, then I think you would have a great argument because you would show that the special damages were already paid for. But isn't the main issue here that it included general damages, things like pain and suffering, which don't have an amount? So perhaps the entire $100,000 only covered the general and never even got to the special, and therefore there was no double recovery here. Isn't that the heart of it?
That goes to the point I made before, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. What I think is really going on here is that we're fashioning a made whole rule that's analogous to the Rhines rule in civil litigation. And if we're going to do that, we should do it explicitly and just say that if a crime victim is not made whole, then we're going to have a hearing on it instead of putting the burden on Mr. Muth to cross-examine crime victims about what they meant when they signed a release. I think the structure that the court has set up here that has evolved and that the state is arguing does not serve the purpose of making victims whole. In fact, I think it does just the opposite. It serves the purpose of deterring fast settlements.
Counsel, on page 4 of your reply brief, you say that the accord takes the place of an itemization of those damages. And I understand that's the argument that you're making. What authority do you have for that statement within the context of restitution?
I don't have any restitution case on that point, Your Honor. That's the general law of accord and satisfaction in contract law. And I would refer the court to the same cases that were cited in the Walters case. That would be, I would have to find them. But
that's fine, counsel. I wanted to know if there was
a Banas case and so on.
Other to support your argument.
There is no specific law that I'm aware of that addresses this issue in regard to restitution law. It's general contract law.
Counsel, I see the statute on restitution 973.20 giving the circuit court lots of room, lots of discretion with regard to ordering restitution. Specifically, 1R states in part 973.20, 1R, that the court shall order the defendant to make full or partial restitution unless the court finds substantial reason not to do so. I mean, So you've got a pretty broad, you can order all the restitution claim, you can order part of the restitution claim, unless you don't want to do that. You know, if the reason is maybe it would be what you're asking for is unlawful pursuant to a case, you know, maybe that kind of thing, or it just doesn't seem equitable, double recovery here. So don't we really paint with a broad brush as long as it's not illegal, that the legislature has given the court really broad discretion under 1R?
I agree with that, Your Honor. Our disagreement is that Mr. Muth was required to bring in extrinsic evidence to prove the meaning of the settlement. I think that's an inappropriate structure for this, but the court certainly has broad powers to do equity and justice.
As a follow-up to that, I mean, I think as evidenced by some questions, there's concern because the Court of Appeals indicates that, look, you have the burden to prove the amount here, and you failed to do that. And that has a lot of persuasive value. But I pause because I think in reality, how is a defendant going to be able to prove when you have a $100,000 settlement that's likely for general damages and maybe not even itemized in people's minds? Look, as was suggested, it's way above $100,000. So we're throwing in the limits right away and that's it. How can the defendant, is it fair to hold the defendant responsible for ascertaining what amount of that $100,000 is due to lost wages?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first response is, I agree, and what a defendant would have to do would be unseemly. We would have to cross-examine crime victims and their families about what was in their mind and what they intended and what their special damages were and what they submitted to insurance companies. That would be...
I have an easier solution for you, counsel. The solution is the settlement agreement itself should list what it was that the parties agreed to for the categories of general and special damages.
I agree with that, Your Honor. If the parties had itemized special damages in the settlement agreement, we wouldn't be having this argument. I think everybody agrees with that. But the accord, as Justice Bradley said, takes the place of that itemization. It resolves disputes as to that itemization, and it stands in the place of that itemization. That's the meaning of accord in accord and satisfaction.
Let me just one more follow-up. I understand that if the settlement agreement had an itemization, that we would be not having this oral argument here today, most likely. But from my perspective, if you have a defendant who may be in no place to control what the insurance company and the victims settle and how they denominate their settlement agreement. I mean, it seems to me most often a defendant will have no ability to say, oh, just by the way, can you itemize that for me? I mean, he's not a party to it. The insurance company controls the settlement, not the insured.
I agree with that. That was a point the state made. The limitation on the insurance company is that they have to act in good faith to protect their insured so that the insured is not exposed to a double recovery. That's the limitation.
Counsel, do you agree with this court statement in Hummel that it is true that restitution in a criminal case is a remedy that belongs to the state, not to the victim?
It is a remedy that belongs to the state, but the amount of that remedy is dependent on the property interests of the victim. So it's a hybrid, Your Honor.
But so do you agree with that statement?
I agree with it in the sense that, well, you asked a fair question. I'll give you a straight answer. No, I don't agree with it entirely because it's a remedy that depends on the property rights of the victim. The state cannot invent victims' property rights.
If the if the remedy belongs to the state, is it possible to have double recovery?
There's no authority for that. Every authority says that double recovery is not permitted, which is why I say it's not entirely a right of the state. It's a interest of the state that's contingent on the property interests of the victim.
Right. So this, thank you for being frank with me. I'll be frank with you as well. I don't agree with the statement in Hummel that it is a remedy that belongs to the state. If it is, then there is no possibility of double recovery. The recovery has to follow the right. And if the right belongs to the state, then the recovery belongs to the state. And if the state wishes to confer that on the defendant, that's up to the state. But it would not appear to be double recovery unless that right belongs to the victim.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think they are interrelated, the victim's property interests and the state's policy interests. Thank you for the opportunity to address you. If there are no other questions, I will yield back to my learned colleague.
Attorney Juris, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'd like to start with discussion of the settlement agreement. As Your Honors...
In that discussion of the settlement agreement, could you describe for me how there could be a possibility of double recovery if restitution is a right that belongs to the state?
Right. I think in that context, when we talk about double recovery in the criminal restitution context, what we mean is the victim ends up receiving more money than she has lost. Then we're talking double recovery in the world of criminal restitution.
But if that's true, then the right belongs to the victim, not to the state.
The right that belongs to the state is the punitive and rehabilitative interest in having that control over the defendant and making sure that he makes his victims whole during the pendency of his criminal sentence. And ultimately, Muth does not dispute the circuit court's fact findings that the victims here suffered both general and special damages. He also does not dispute the fact finding that he failed to show what portion of that settlement covered general as opposed to special damages. Perhaps 99 of the $100,000 went to general damages. We simply don't know. And if we don't know, then the right answer is for the court to impose restitution, because remember, as Your Honors have recognized, a circuit court has a duty to impose restitution unless it finds a substantial reason not to do so. And so it is fair to put that burden on the defendant. And while I understand that in the context of a car insurance agreement, it may be challenging for the level of specificity that would be required to be present, but I would also note that the punitive and rehabilitative purposes of criminal restitution are not advanced by the defendant's car insurance company paying restitution or offsetting or completely barring restitution obligations of the defendant. And so unless he can prove that that particular amount goes to the same losses, it is fair to put that burden on the defendant to make that showing. And I would also just note that this is nothing new. In this court's decision in Sweat in the 1990s, Justice Wilcox, in his concurrence, specifically noted, if parties want civil settlement agreements to serve to limit restitution amounts, they should say so and clearly in the settlement agreement.
But isn't that accomplished by releasing all claims?
It's not, because as this court said in Sweat, as the Court of Appeals said in Walters, and this court again emphasized in Hummel, restitution cannot, a civil settlement agreement cannot serve as a bar to liability. And so that cannot, that language, while it could work to bar all further civil liability, cannot, in essence, negotiate away a circuit court's responsibility to work under our restitution statute to make the crime victim whole. And so
that's based on the premise that the right belongs to the state, isn't it?
I don't think it's necessarily just based on that premise. I think we're talking about the fundamentally different purposes between resolving civil disputes and criminal restitution and criminal sentences.
Yeah, I get the different purposes, but it's the ownership of the right that's important here, right? Because if it belongs to the victim, then the victim can bargain it away. If it belongs to the state, then the victim cannot.
I think the purposes of that of this criminal restitution versus civil litigation really should be the focus here. And this is nothing new. This court has said that both in Sweat and in Hummel, and the Court of Appeals held the same in Walters. And so I think that really is the driving focus. And again, because it goes back to the goal of restitution to make the crime victim whole. And so otherwise, it would put victims in the horrible position of having to decide. Let's say, for example, there is a civil settlement. May I briefly conclude?
Yeah, please just conclude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It would put victims in the horrible position of having to perhaps accept a much lower payment in advance from an insurance company than to what they're entitled, knowing that then they would at least recover some money, versus having to wait and see if they could recover that as restitution, and where the goals of the restitution statute are to to compensate the victims, but also punish and rehabilitate the defendant. We shouldn't overturn Walters simply to make it easier for criminal defendants to avoid paying restitution. Thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, thank you both. You both are really wonderful oralists. I don't know if anybody's told you that before, but you are very, very good. Your briefs are very good, too. But you answer the court's question, which is sometimes hard, because when you come to court, you have something that you'd like to say and you have a way you'd like to say it. So you both did a great job. Now, before we conclude, Rebecca Bradley, do you have something for us?
I do. Thank you, Chief Justice Rogensack. As today is the court's last scheduled oral argument, I would like to take this opportunity to recognize Justice Daniel Kelly for his outstanding work and service to the people of Wisconsin. Justice Kelly has authored some of the most important opinions of this court. He has been a faithful guardian of the Constitution and a staunch defender of the rule of law, always applying the law as it is written and not as he may wish it to be. Justice Kelly's scholarship, intellect, work ethic, and collegiality are irreplaceable. As a justice, as in all areas of his life, he always acts with utmost integrity and with honor. Justice Kelly's departure from this court is a grave loss, not only to the court as an institution, but most importantly, to the people of Wisconsin whom we serve. Thank you, Justice Kelly, for your devoted service as a member of the judiciary. You have been a wonderful colleague and a good friend, and you will be greatly missed.
Thank you so much.
Justice Bradley. And I would join her comments, and if we were in court together, we would all stand and give you a standing ovation for your service, Justice Kelly, but we'll have to do it this way today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, we are adjourned, and the court will meet in closed conference at 11 o'clock. Thank you.